The focus of this module today will be to look at the management and assessment of psychotic symptoms and psychotic illness as they arise following traumatic brain injury. Throughout the talk, I will describe what the key terms are with regards to psychosis and psychotic illness, look at the incidence of the condition following traumatic brain injury, and what etiological factors appear to be important for the emergence of psychotic illness. I will then go on to talk about the assessment of a person with a traumatic brain injury and the management of this person and their psychosis following their traumatic brain injury. Psychosis is, in its broadest definition, a disturbance of reality testing. The person's perception of what is happening in the real world is altered by the illness, and it has no comparison with what is occurring in the real world. Psychosis is characterised by the experience of hallucinations, delusions, and thought disorder. Delusions are false fixed ideas that a person holds, and these ideas are contrary to their cultural, social, or religious beliefs. The person maintains the idea despite being given evidence to the contrary. Another important factor about delusional ideas is that the delusional idea must cause the person to change in terms of their emotions, their behaviour, or their feeling state and thought processes, and that they have to act on this idea. If the person has an abnormal idea that is not consistent with their reality, but it doesn't cause a change in behaviour or emotional experience, we often call that an overvalued idea. Overvalued ideas are also found in psychotic states. Hallucinations are the experience of perceptual phenomena in external reality where there is no stimulus in that external reality. So, for example, a person will hear the sounds or voices talking to them, but there is in fact no sound in external reality. Hallucinations can also take the form of visual experiences, tactile experiences, and olfactory, or they will sense and have the experience of smelling things that do not actually occur. In the past, it was thought that the auditory hallucinations were particularly found only in the schizophrenias or functional psychiatric illness, and that the hallucinations such as visual hallucinations or sensory somatic hallucinations were more commonly found in organic states. Thought disorder is when a person's ability to construct their ideas and express those ideas is disturbed. And so, for example, they'll have problems with regards to their grammatical construction of sentences. They may have things such as clang associations, where each sentence ends with the same word and has a very rhythmic quality about it. Thought disorder can be quite difficult to diagnose in people who also have a head injury or any other damage to the central nervous system, because of course the central nervous system is very important for the control and production of language, and so people can have a stroke or traumatic brain injury in the areas of the brain that control language, and they will have a problem with production of language. We don't normally call that thought disorder, we would call that dysphasia, but the differentiation between the two can be quite difficult. As far as the different diagnoses that you can see in following brain injury where a person is psychotic, there are a variety of diagnoses that we need to remember. The one that should be used if we're using the DSM-4 process is that of schizophrenia due to a head injury. As with all other DSM-4 diagnoses, the important factor here is that we can define quite clearly the relationship between the head injury and the onset of the psychotic symptoms, and that relationship is quite close together. If you are fairly certain that you can say that the psychotic symptoms have emerged following the brain injury and that the brain injury has caused them, then the correct diagnosis is a schizophrenia due to a head injury. Other diagnoses that might be appropriate include that of schizophrenia, and often that will be if the temporal relationship is quite distant, schizophreniform psychosis, a brief reactive psychosis, but also a delusional disorder, a hallucinatory disorder, and also a schizoaffective disorder and mania. In mania, it's important that the person have a mood change as well as the psychotic symptomatology, and the mood change is typically that of a positive mood change, and the psychotic symptoms are very much part of that mood disorder. I won't speak a great deal about mania in this presentation. It's very much part of the bipolar disorders or the mood spectrum disorders. Other diagnoses that we consider that where there might be psychotic symptoms is that of a delirium. Patients who are in post-traumatic amnesia have a state which is the same as delirium, and in a delirium, psychotic symptoms can occur quite commonly. It's very important in the area of head injury to be aware that the psychotic symptoms that a person might experience when they are in post-traumatic amnesia does not appear to have any kind of ramifications in terms of the emergence of psychotic symptoms once they've gone out of the period of post-traumatic amnesia. Psychotic symptoms are very common in deliriums, and in particular, patients are very confused, they're unable to interpret what's happening in external reality well, and they will have perceptual abnormalities and thought abnormalities that are purely a phenomena of the delirium. People who are demented might also get psychotic symptoms, and there is the diagnosis of a dementia due to a traumatic brain injury. Patients who have this dementia may have delusional ideas and hallucinations. Interestingly enough, if they have delusional ideas as part of their dementia, they're often very simple ideas and they can change over time. The management of that person is more influenced by the extent of their cognitive impairments rather than the presence or absence of delusional ideas. And finally, people who have had a head injury and are psychotic may in fact have a drug-induced psychosis, and this is one of the other differential diagnoses that we need to consider. Throughout the presentation of psychotic disorders following brain injury, I'm going to focus on one particular case that I think demonstrates quite adequately a number of aspects about psychotic illnesses following traumatic brain injury. This is the case of Miss G. Miss G was a lady who was referred to myself for treatment. She was 23 years of age at the time that she had her traumatic brain injury. She was a front seat passenger in a car wearing a seatbelt, and the driver of the vehicle lost control and the car collided with a tree. She was the only person in the accident that was seriously injured. When the ambulance arrived at the scene of the accident, she had a Glasgow Coma score of 13. She was confused yet awake. However, by the time she arrived at the treating hospital, her Glasgow Coma score had deteriorated to 6. Initial assessment on CT scanning demonstrated a right frontal contusion, and she then didn't go on to have further imaging studies until many years following her brain injury. Her initial neuropsychometric assessment when she emerged from post-traumatic amnesia demonstrated quite widespread impairments, both in verbal and visual memory, and particularly impairments of frontal lobe functioning, and she had a significant lack of awareness in terms of the extent of her cognitive impairments. Her period of post-traumatic amnesia was 6 weeks, which we would consider to be an extremely severe head injury. At the time that the accident occurred, she was recently married, and following her acute care treatment, she was transferred to a brain injury rehabilitation program and then subsequently discharged home into the care of her extended family. When she was in the rehabilitation facility, she became very paranoid and suspicious about her family members, to the point where they were prevented from visiting her and guardianship orders were taken to allow her in-laws and husband to make decisions regarding her medical care. Not a lot was thought about this at the time. When she was initially referred, it was some 6 weeks after the death of her father. She was noted to be very depressed, and she was being referred for management of her depressive illness. I found her to be depressed with a sleep disturbance. She was very agitated and anxious and spoke at length about how badly her family treated her. Over time, it emerged that her family had a very negative viewpoint about her, even prior to the injury, that she was always seen as being a very difficult and problematic child, despite the fact that academically and professionally she had done very well before the head injury. There were a number of cultural factors that were very important in her case. She was a first-generation Australian, her parents were originally from Greece, and they had a very negative viewpoint about her independence and autonomy prior to the time of the injury. Her marriage was also a situation where the family were not really happy with the person she married. When she was discharged from hospital and she went to live with her in-laws and her husband, she became very paranoid and suspicious about their actions, felt that they were inhibiting her recovery, taking things from her, hiding things, and she moved back home to her parents. It was after she was back home that her father died. When she first came to see me, it was felt that a lot of the paranoid ideas she had were in fact quite reasonable, that the family had in fact treated her very badly over the past, and not a great deal was made about her psychotic symptomatology or what might have been psychotic symptomatology, and she was effectively being managed from the point of view of a grief disorder and a major depression. So how common are psychotic illnesses following traumatic brain injury? As I've mentioned in other modules, one of the problems with regards to the incidence of psychiatric illness following head injury is that very frequently the method in which the assessment is made varies between the studies. So, for example, some studies might look at the incidence of psychotic symptoms, other studies will look at the incidence of a disorder called schizophrenia following head injury, and then, of course, there are the studies where there is no definition of what the authors meant of the term psychosis, but that they were simply detecting psychosis following brain injury. Because of these differences in the studies, there is in fact a great deal of variability with regards to the incidence of the psychotic illnesses following head injury. If you look at all the studies and compare the rates of psychotic illness, you see in fact a great deal of variability. In some studies, the incidence is in fact quite low and less than that of the general population at a rate of about 0.07%, and in other studies, the rate is actually quite high, going up to about 9.8% as an average of the incidence of psychotic illness following brain injury. This rate of 9.8% is higher than that we see in the general population, and it's about 2 to 3 times higher, depending on how the term psychosis is defined and also depending on what diagnostic groups are included in the epidemiological studies. One of the other problems with looking at the studies in terms of the incidence of psychotic illness is the definition of the authors as to how significant the head injury is as far as the onset of the psychosis is concerned. So, for example, in some studies, they will consider psychotic illnesses that have emerged 50 years following the head injury as being related to the brain injury. Obviously, this produces a great deal of variability in the studies. One of the things that we can say is that in studies where there are more significantly injured people, so people who have had a severe brain injury, as I defined in one of the earlier modules, that the rate of psychosis appears to be a lot higher. In studies where there is a mixed severity, so for example we include mild, moderate and severe injuries, the incidence of psychotic symptoms is about 9%. If you limit it to people who are more severely injured, then the incident goes up to about 15%, which is significantly higher than that we see in the general population. One of the very important things to also comment on, particularly for some of the earlier studies, is that the patients that were included in these studies were patients who had open head injuries, so they had penetrating wounds, and there is a significant difference between the patient population we see now with closed head injury and those that were included in the earlier studies. Unfortunately, it's the earlier studies from the 50s and 60s with the open head injuries where they've got the greatest number of patients and the best information in terms of follow-up studies. So I think there's still a lot of work has to be done regarding the incidence, but as a general rule, we can say that psychotic symptoms and psychotic illness occurs more commonly in people who've had a significant head injury than we would expect in the general population. So why do people develop psychotic illnesses after head injury? Looking at this is in fact quite important, and the area of understanding the neuroanatomy and the functional neuroanatomy of the brain becomes quite important when we're looking at the etiology of why people become psychotic following a head injury. Some of the earliest work that was done in this area was really to try and help people understand much more about schizophrenia in general. People with schizophrenia are known to have abnormalities on neuroimaging, for example, dilated ventricles, and they've also known to have abnormalities on neuropsychometric assessment. It then became quite obvious that if we had people who had structural injury to the brain and became psychotic, that studying those patients might help us to understand what it is about schizophrenia or what's happening to the brain in schizophrenia to help the management of what is a significant illness in our community. Unfortunately, because of the diversity of the studies that I've previously mentioned, in particular the inclusion of both open and closed head injury and mild, moderate and severe brain injury, it's been very difficult to point to any one particular etiological factor that seems to be important in the emergence of psychosis following brain injury. What we can say is that the severity of the injury and the location of the lesion seems to be significant. So, for example, the more severe your brain injury, the increased risk you have of developing a psychotic illness. As you might recall from an earlier module, I did indicate that the distribution of severity of injury and the emergence of psychotic symptoms is not a direct linear relationship. So, for example, people with mild brain injury don't necessarily have less risk of a psychiatric illness and those with extremely severe brain injuries an increased risk, because you do need to have a certain degree of cognitive functioning and in particular language ability to be able to communicate that you are psychotic. So we really don't have a very good understanding as to how frequent psychotic symptoms and illnesses are in the extremely severely brain injured, those people who are often in what we call persistent vegetative states. But we do know in people who have had severe brain injuries that the rate of psychosis is higher, so that severity is an important factor. The other important factor appears to be where the lesions are or where the predominant lesion is following a traumatic brain injury. As you know, with modern traumatic brain injury, they are predominantly closed head injuries, and so they are diffuse changes in the brain. Although some patients will have localised infarctions or contusions as well as more generalised injury. What we can say in looking at people who are psychotic following their head injury, that damage to the left temporal area appears to be quite important for the emergence of psychotic symptoms, in particular auditory hallucinations. Damage in the right non-parietal area is also significant for the emergence of particularly paranoid delusional ideas. And patients who have predominant right hemisphere lesions, particularly the frontal and parietal areas, do seem to have an increased tendency to developing delusional ideas. We know that there is an increased risk of developing psychosis if there is epilepsy, in particular temporal lobe epilepsy. Why this might be seems to be related to the fact that when people have epilepsy, they can not only have clear abnormal electrical activity that is reflected in having a seizure, but that they have what's called a kindling phenomena or sub-threshold abnormal electrical energies, and that this stimulation produces the hallucinatory experiences that we commonly see in psychotic symptomatology. If a person has a brain injury in childhood, there does appear to be an increased vulnerability to the development of psychosis and schizophrenia. There have been a number of studies of patients in general psychiatric wards who have schizophrenia, and it has been found that if the person had a significant brain injury before the age of 10, that they had an increased risk of developing schizophrenia in adulthood. In an Australian study by Sachdev and Smith, in New South Wales, they actually found that having a family history of psychosis increased the likelihood of a person with a brain injury having a psychosis subsequently. The family history finding has only been found in the study by Sachdev, and other studies in fact have indicated that family history is not a contributing factor to the emergence of psychosis following brain injury. What we can say is that when a person has a brain injury, there is actually a neurological effect from that brain injury, and that this causes a change in not only the structure of the brain, but how it functions. The other thing that we need to remember when a person has a head injury is that it actually induces a very significant psychosocial stress on that individual. They think differently, they may in fact be unable to move or communicate the same way, and frequently there are changes in their ability to work, to relate to their friends and family, and this all causes a significant amount of stress. We also know that stress can precipitate psychiatric illness. So if you have a person who has a brain injury, particularly involving the left temporal area, the right parietal areas, and they find this experience to be extremely stressful, they may be vulnerable to the development of psychotic symptoms. In the case of Miss G, she quite clearly had on initial imaging evidence of damage to the right frontal area, and I did describe her as having very marked limited awareness about the impairments that she had. So she seemed to have problems accepting the changes that had occurred to her. This would obviously put her in a situation of being more vulnerable to misinterpreting what was happening, in the sense that if she misplaced things, rather than accepting that she misplaced things, that she had a problem with her memory, she had the tendency of blaming others. Spitzer, who is a psychiatrist in Europe, has very eloquently looked at this process of having abnormal thoughts or aberrant thoughts, and he's put forward that people develop delusional ideas because they constantly have an abnormal thought process, and that abnormal thought process is being reinforced, and that finally they lay down permanent pathways in the brain involving these abnormal thought processes. So in the case of Miss G, she constantly misplaced things, but rather than accept that she had the impairment herself, what she ended up doing was blaming others and becoming very paranoid. One of the important things when looking at psychotic illness following brain injury is to try and understand whether it is in fact different from schizophrenia or the same, whether there are any commonalities and what are the important differences. One of the problems that people in rehabilitation settings often find is trying to communicate to mental health services that the person's symptomatology is not characteristic of what you see following brain injury. And mental health services thinking that the psychotic symptoms are in fact different to what might occur in schizophrenia. There have been a number of studies that have attempted to characterise psychosis in organic states and compare it to patients who have schizophrenia and to compare it to patients who've had a head injury who do not have a mental illness. And the findings are really quite interesting. When we look at patients who develop schizophrenia-like illnesses following traumatic brain injury, what we see, in fact, is that they have a predominance of paranoid delusional ideas. I mentioned in the very early part of this module that in the early days it was believed that, for example, hallucinations in organic states were more likely to be visual or somatic or olfactory. And there also used to be the belief that if people became psychotic after an organic impairment, that the delusional ideas tended to be ideas about duplication or substitution of important people, the classic kind of Capgras syndrome that you might read about in psychiatry textbooks. Well, what's really interesting when you look at a group of patients who've had traumatic brain injury and become psychotic is in fact that they don't have these characteristic delusional ideas that were always thought to be associated with organic states. In fact, they have predominant paranoid delusional ideas which are exactly the same as what you see in schizophrenia. And in fact, it can be impossible to distinguish the person between that of a schizophrenic illness that is a functional state and an organic schizophrenic illness based on their delusional ideas. The delusional ideas, the paranoid ideas, are very typical of what you see in schizophrenia, ideas that people are trying to harm them or do things to them. What can add to the complexity of the assessment is that in cases where people have had a traumatic brain injury and litigation is involved, they can in fact be followed by insurance companies and filmed, and so it can become even more difficult to work out whether what they're saying is a delusional idea or whether in fact is an experience in reality. And this is an added complication that one needs to keep in mind when seeing people who are psychotic following head injury, that some of their paranoid ideas may in fact not be delusional, but ideas that are based on their real experiences. And that's where it becomes important in assessing them to ask other people what is actually going on in this person's life. One of the other things that I mentioned was this notion of hallucinations and that the hallucinations were characteristic in organic states. Well, interestingly enough, again, the studies that have looked at the experience of hallucinations following head injury have not found that patients with organic psychosis or psychosis after head injury have more olfactory or visual hallucinations. In fact, they tend to have more auditory hallucinations. I mentioned the study of Sachdev, and in also a clinical case study that I have completed, the majority of patients had auditory hallucinations. The hallucinations could include hearing music, hearing conversations, hearing their name being called, and the classic description of experiencing the sensation in external reality. They believe that the voice or sound is really in their environment. They often find it quite distressing because they can't locate where the experience is coming from. And of course, most people in the community associate hallucinations with being mad or mentally ill. And so the person with the head injury becomes quite traumatised and distressed by experiencing these hallucinations. They will have olfactory hallucinations and visual hallucinations. It's important to bear in mind that olfactory hallucinations can be part of the phenomena of temporal lobe epilepsy. And when I talk about the assessment, I'll raise this again. Thought disorder is in fact extremely rare in psychotic states following head injury. So you rarely see a situation where a person didn't have a speech or language impairment that then develops as the psychosis develops. One of the other things that we know about psychotic illnesses after head injury is in fact that the more positive symptoms of psychosis are more common. As you might be aware, in schizophrenia there are the positive symptoms, the hallucinations, the delusions, the thought disorder, and behaviour that might reflect this. And there are also what we call the negative symptoms, so the changes in socialisation, communication, and there might also be changes in terms of how the person takes care of themselves or relates in their environment. In people who develop a psychotic illness after a head injury, we tend to see the positive symptoms much more commonly, and we don't see a lot of the negative symptoms emerging. One of the important things, however, to remember is that people who have head injuries may have impairments in their social skills as part of their brain injury. They might also have difficulties with drive and initiative that is again part of their brain injury and may not necessarily be related to their psychosis. What you would typically see is that you have an assessment of the impairments the person has had with the brain injury and then the emergence of the psychotic symptoms. If they get a deterioration in their social skills or functioning, you can attribute that to the psychosis following the brain injury, but it's important to bear in mind that these negative symptoms are in fact very rare in the organic states and in the organic psychotic conditions. One of the things that is very common, however, is the presence of agitation and aggression. And the incidence of aggressive behaviour in people who have psychotic illness following head injury is actually higher than that you see in schizophrenic populations. We know that the presence of aggressive behaviour is often quite a significant stress, but it's also what often brings people towards to attention for services and intervention. In a case review of 50 patients that I have treated with psychotic symptoms, the early referrals were frequently for aggressive behaviour rather than psychotic symptoms. Over time, there has been an increased awareness about the emergence of psychotic symptoms, and the referrals are now more accurate. But this problem or this phenomena of people being aggressive due to their psychotic ideas is in fact quite common. So we have a person who appears to have a psychotic illness after a brain injury, and we need to look at how we're going to assess that person. In the case of Miss G, I mentioned the fact that her family were in fact quite negative and hostile towards her. Unfortunately, they weren't actually prepared to be involved in the assessment and ongoing management process of Miss G because of a long-standing pre-existing problems within the family. In the case of a person who has a psychotic illness, it's extremely important to emphasise that we need to interview not only the patient but important people who are involved with that person. A classic case is that occurred in my practice the other week was a young patient that I see who has a very well-established schizoaffective disorder. He was admitted to hospital due to the complications associated with the treatment of this schizoaffective disorder, and the hospital staff chose to discharge him, attributing his behaviour as being related to frontal lobe impairment. No one of the treating team actually spoke to his carers, or in fact to his treating psychiatrist, to be able to determine anything about him and what he was normally like. It was in fact after conversing with them that it became very evident that the behaviour he was manifesting was very common of what was seen when he was psychotic. And in fact that if they had spoken to his carers, they would have been aware that he was in fact frankly delusional and experiencing auditory hallucinations. Often people who are head injured are actually quite concerned about relating to people they don't know. They won't communicate necessarily that well. So in that half hour or an hour that a psychiatrist or a mental health worker has to do an assessment, it's pretty rare that the psychiatrist or the mental health worker will be able to in fact elicit the psychotic symptomatology. As I've mentioned in earlier modules, there are also the problems to do with memory and concentration, so that patients may not be able to concentrate long enough to give you an adequate history, or more importantly, that they don't actually remember the ideas. So unless they're actually experiencing when the person's assessing them, they have no idea that this is actually going on, so they can't relate the history. So not only interviewing the patient, but interviewing significant others, carers, family members, or people in the community who know this person well is really important in the assessment. If I had been able to get more information about Miss G from family and people that knew her well, it might have assisted in terms of my diagnosis at an earlier stage. One of the very important things as far as assessment is concerned, particularly in psychotic symptoms, is the notion of dangerousness. In earlier modules, I haven't mentioned the concept of dangerousness because while people who are depressed may be suicidal, the dangerousness that's associated with psychosis is not only to the person who is psychotic, but might also be to the community. What typically happens when people are delusional is that the people in their community challenge their delusional ideas. For example, I have a patient who always believes he's met you in the past and that you have a relationship with Elvis. If you actually try and correct that belief system with him, he in fact becomes very agitated, and in the past he used to in fact become quite aggressive. So the concept of dangerousness is extremely important, and in the assessment process this really should take a very important part of the assessment, working out whether or not the person is going to harm not only themselves but others based on their delusional ideas. It's also important to understand when the person might become aggressive as far as their assessment of dangerousness is concerned, because that's going to help as far as your management is concerned. In New South Wales, we have the Mental Health Act, which enables us to detain people and protect them from themselves and the community if there is dangerousness associated with their mental illness. Of course, this can be a bit of a problem instituting the Mental Health Act when someone has a significant organic lesion, because sometimes mental health staff don't necessarily understand that psychosis is not a normal phenomenon of traumatic brain injury, and they might want to dismiss the psychotic symptoms as being part of just what a person has with a head injury. And of course, rehabilitation staff may not necessarily be aware that mental health workers haven't seen a lot of traumatic brain injured people who aren't psychotic, and therefore may not necessarily know that the experience of hallucinations and delusions when a person is out of post-traumatic amnesia is not what we would normally see following a traumatic brain injury. If a person is a danger to themselves or others and they are psychotic or having hallucinations or behaving in a way that suggests this is the case, then you can use the Mental Health Act. The Guardianship Act can really only be used if the person can't consent to the treatment because they're so cognitively impaired that their ability to make a reasonable decision has been affected by the head injury. So generally when someone's mentally ill, guardianship boards and guardians are a bit reluctant to order that people are detained in hospital because their mental illness is what's requiring them to be detained in hospital. In the assessment phase, it's also, I think, fairly important to look at the investigations that are necessary. And one of the key investigations that we need to do is an EEG. I mentioned earlier that temporal lobe epilepsy associated with this can be the experience of olfactory hallucinations, and that also we can have disturbances of behaviour, deja vu experiences, purely associated with epilepsy. In my case study of 50 patients who had psychotic symptoms following brain injury, two of those patients referred had previously undiagnosed frontotemporal epilepsy. And the association of psychotic symptoms with epilepsy was that when their epilepsy was poorly controlled, they had more psychotic symptoms. So while an EEG is often thought not to be a very useful investigation, it in fact can be very useful in the area of psychosis. If the person hasn't had any kind of neuroimaging for a long period of time, it's also important in this situation to do some investigations, a CT scan or an MRI, depending on what is considered to be the most pertinent for that person. With the neuroimaging, you're really looking for other types of pathology, for example, hydrocephalus, or sometimes coexistent pathology. The person may have a previously undiagnosed, for example, brain tumour that can be contributing to their mental state. Finally, it's important to screen for electrolyte abnormalities and endocrine abnormalities, as psychotic symptoms can be associated, particularly with disturbances in the levels of sodium, potassium, and also changes in the level of calcium. Finally, a urinary drug screen is often quite important, particularly if you're looking at the management phase of such a patient. You know, if they're abusing cannabis and they're psychotic, it's really important to know that because that's going to influence your longer-term management. As far as management's concerned, it's important, I think, to always, in this situation, consider the differential diagnosis of the person with a psychotic illness. Do they have predominant mood symptoms? Could this presentation be part of a bipolar disorder? If they have predominant mood symptoms, it will also influence the choice of agents that we're going to use to manage this condition. It's important to remember that in psychotic symptoms, mood symptoms can be part of the prodrome, and they can also be part of the post-psychotic phase. In the patient population that I've seen, about 50% of psychotic patients will also have significant mood symptoms, and usually they'll be significant depressive symptoms. The manic symptoms are in fact rarer, but the mood symptoms can be quite significant and obviously are going to require treatment and care. When looking at management, we often have to consider the notion of whether the person's going to need inpatient care in contrast to outpatient care. Because psychosis can cause such a significant disruption to the person at home, and because there is an increased association with psychotic symptoms and aggression and agitation, this might be a situation where it's appropriate to briefly admit the person to hospital. The other issue, of course, is that people who have an organic psychosis can often react differently to the antipsychotics than one might normally expect or have more significant side effects, and so again, admitting them to hospital to initiate treatment may be a reasonable option. Any person who's a danger to themselves or others warrants detention under the Mental Health Act and admission to a psychiatric hospital. One of the challenges that we have in managing people who are psychotic is this issue of consent. I've briefly mentioned that if a person can't consent because of their cognitive impairment, that we may need to utilise guardianship legislation or approach a guardian if one exists. But you actually have this dual process in psychosis after a head injury where you've got the person who is psychotic and has an impaired awareness usually about their psychosis. It's pretty rare that the psychotic brain injured person will say, oh yes, that's a delusional idea. Usually they've got no awareness that they're psychotic. And they also then have often problems with awareness about the treatment and the implications, and they might lack the cognitive ability to make an appropriate decision. So quite often what you need to do is defer getting valid consent for treatment until the person is more settled and initiating treatment based on the symptom complaints they have. Frequently, management can be targeted towards a specific symptom complaint the patient has. For example, they might not complain about their delusions, they might complain about their sleep impairment. You're going to prescribe medication to improve their sleep, and when their psychosis settles, discuss some of the psychotic symptoms subsequently and then get informed consent. It's important, however, to document why consent wasn't obtained when initiating treatment. In psychosis following traumatic brain injury, I think the first step is always going to be pharmacological. The utilisation of other strategies such as psychological interventions or social therapies have a place, but in the state of an acute psychotic process, pharmacological management is always really important. And there are very rare situations where we wouldn't institute pharmacological management. Obviously, if we haven't made the diagnosis, we can't. And this can be, in fact, a very big challenge, making the accurate diagnosis. In the case of Miss G, some 2 years after she was seeing me, she went away on a holiday up to the north coast of Queensland. And when she was there, she, in fact, became quite frankly psychotic, that the resort staff contacted the rooms to indicate that she had barraged, that she'd locked herself in her room, that she was constantly going through her bags looking for belongings that she believed had been taken away. And we had to transfer her back to Sydney and, in fact, admit her to hospital. At that stage, she was very frank about her delusional ideas, and the fact that the ideas she'd previously had, the paranoia about the family, you could see how those ideas couldn't have been based in reality when she was up in the north coast of Queensland, and it became quite obvious then that she was delusional. As I've stated, she was admitted to hospital. She was quite agitated, not sleeping, and quite disturbed in her behaviour, and admission to hospital was considered to be appropriate in this situation. Sometimes, however, we might decide not to treat psychotic symptoms, and there can be a few situations where this occurs. Almost certainly, if the psychotic symptoms don't distress the person who's having them, and the risk of treatment outweighs the benefits of getting rid of the psychotic symptoms, then it might be reasonable simply to monitor the symptomatology. I have a rare situation where a patient of mine has a delusional idea that has developed as a result of his tinnitus, and he finds that delusional idea, in fact, quite comforting. He's obviously not keen to lose the experience by having medication, and he seems to have some insight that the idea might be considered strange and odd, and it doesn't have a negative impact of how he does his work. So we've agreed to simply monitor the situation and not treat it. But that's actually fairly rare, and in most cases we're going to need to treat it and to use pharmacological agents. The mainstay of treatment, of course, is what we call neuroleptics or antipsychotics, and there are two broad groups of antipsychotics. We have what are called the typical antipsychotics and the atypicals. The typical antipsychotics have been around now for about 50 years. They are predominantly the phenothiazines, drugs such as chlorpromazine, stelazine, and these medications have been used now for many years for the treatment of schizophrenia. What we know about the typical neuroleptics is that they're very effective for treating the acute symptoms, but they're not very good for treating the negative symptoms associated with psychosis. And we also know that the side effects are in fact quite disabling. And in the typical neuroleptics, there are a lot of neurological side effects that you get. People can have Parkinsonian syndromes, what are called acute dystonic reactions. They may also get quite significant agitation or akathisia. And in the longer term, they can get a condition called tardive dyskinesia, which is a repetitive movement disorder that is persistent or permanent and quite disabling to the person who has it. So the typical neuroleptics have traditionally been used for the management of psychosis following head injury, but they're not without their problems. In the past 15 years or so, we have had available to treat psychosis drugs that are called atypical neuroleptics. predominantly the reason they're called atypical is that they don't just work on dopamine, they also work on other neuroreceptors, and they tend to work not only just in the areas of the limbic area, but also in the frontal regions of the brain. And they have quite a different profile as far as side effects are concerned. There really are no good controlled studies looking at the atypical neuroleptics in people who have had head injuries and are psychotic. So most of the information we have about using these drugs is anecdotal, based on case reports or individual clinician experience. Risperidone has been studied in a few very small studies looking at its effectiveness in organic psychotic states, and it has shown to be effective and to be well tolerated without any undue or significant side effects. Clozapine is another atypical that in fact has been studied in head injured people. For those of you who are listening to this talk, you might be quite surprised that clozapine has been used in people who are head injured. Clozapine, as we know, is an atypical neuroleptic that is the most effective agent that we have. However, it has quite significant side effects associated with its use, and those side effects can be life-threatening. So the prescription of clozapine is in fact very strongly controlled and restricted to people who have treatment-resistant psychosis. Clozapine, however, is a very interesting drug. It's been found to be very effective in psychosis following head injury, and particularly in those patients who are very agitated. There have also been more recent studies in non-head injured populations where clozapine has been found to be more effective than other agents when patients are suicidal and psychotic. So clozapine can be used quite safely in head injured people. One of the side effects of clozapine, apart from its hematological problems, which is why it's so closely monitored, is in fact that it can cause seizures at higher doses. Interestingly enough, in the head injured patients that I have treated with clozapine for their treatment-resistant psychosis, seizures have not been a problem. And in the case report of 10 cases that was published in the United States using clozapine and in head-injured people, again, seizure disorders was not a significant problem that could not be managed with the appropriate use of anticonvulsants. One word of warning with clozapine is that you can't use clozapine and tegretol together, because tegretol affects white cell count, as does the clozapine, so the combined use of these two agents is prohibited and not considered to be safe, but you can use the other anticonvulsants quite safely with clozapine, and this combination can be combined if necessary if the person has both epilepsy and a treatment-resistant psychosis. One of the things that I need to raise is the negative effect that neuroleptics can have. And while we don't have any studies as to the negative effects of atypical neuroleptics, I can say that there have been some animal studies looking at haloperidol and recovery of brain function. And haloperidol has been shown in animal studies to retard recovery of brain function, particularly in the acute phase. And so we need to consider quite carefully why we're using the neuroleptics and which neuroleptics we're going to use. I don't know whether this effect on retarding brain recovery is going to be the same with the atypical neuroleptics, but obviously we need to keep that in mind. As far as the pharmacology is concerned, we need to try and remember to use the lowest dose possible for the patients so that they don't get any adverse side effects. In the patient population that I treat, and in the case of Miss G, we used atypical neuroleptic agents. They were considered to be the best drug for the person, and in particular because they don't have an adverse effect on memory and cognitive functioning, as some of the typical neuroleptics do. However, there are some problems with regards to using the atypical neuroleptics, and in particular the side effects of weight gain and the effect on prolactin are ones that we need to remember. Drugs such as clozapine and olanzapine cause quite significant weight gain in patients who have psychosis. And in someone who's had a traumatic brain injury, and in particular if they've got a gait or balance impairment, this weight gain can have quite an adverse effect on their ability to participate in their physical therapies. And so we need to be cautious about the use of such agents. Unfortunately, particularly with olanzapine, it's one of these rare drugs that comes as a wafer form. It's quite sedating and very settling in acute agitation. So it in fact is a drug that you'd really want to use in an acute psychotic state, but the weight gain problem is something that you really need to keep in mind. Some of the other neuroleptics, atypical neuroleptics that we use, particularly risperidone and amisulpride, can have quite a significant effect on prolactin. So they can cause breast enlargement, they can also cause menstrual irregularities, and that's going to cause a problem, particularly in women who are brain injured, who may not be able to comply that well with their contraceptive therapy, if they're not having periods, they could well fall pregnant if they're indiscriminate with their sexual activity. So the drugs that affect prolactin can affect their ability to regulate their contraception, and this needs to be kept in mind. One of the things that I quite commonly do clinically with my patients who are psychotic is practice what I call a switching regime. So I might start them on olanzapine wafers because it's easy to administer. Compliance is not a problem in this case because it's once the wafer goes in the mouth, the person can't actually spit it out. And stabilise them on the olanzapine wafer, get the psychotic symptoms well controlled, and then switch them to a less sedating antipsychotic and one that has less effects as far as weight gain is concerned. So quetiapine has less of a weight effect than, for example, olanzapine or clozaril, and also aripiprazole, which is a newer atypical antipsychotic, also doesn't have that weight effect. And so sometimes starting them on one agent and switching them after about 4 to 6 weeks can be quite effective in terms of optimising the therapy, but trying to minimise the side effects. There's no published studies looking at the use of depot preparations in psychosis following head injury. In the cases of functional psychosis, for example, schizophrenia, we quite commonly use depot preparations for patients who lack insight to recognise that they need treatment or where compliance is a problem. Obviously, in head-injured patients, compliance is actually quite a significant problem. You know, they forget to turn up to appointments and they also forget to take their medication. If they've got complex dosing regimes, their compliance is even more significantly affected. And so that's where often a depot medication can come in use and be quite handy. Unfortunately, there's only one atypical depot preparation, that's risperidone, and this depot preparation currently is extremely expensive, and so its use is really quite limited in the community. There's also no case studies or published studies about its effectiveness in organic populations, so we still have to put that as a possible rather than as a useful therapy or strategy. The other thing that we need to remember is that with the depot preparations, we're talking about the typical agents and that the side effect profile is often one that we wish to avoid in our patients with traumatic brain injury. So if at all possible, I think it's useful to try and avoid the depot preparations because they really do get quite significant side effects with these agents and it's a less than optimal therapy. But if you have no other choice, then it can be used. I tend to use clofenthixole as the depot preparation as it seems to have the least number of side effects in this patient population. Finally, in patients who are psychotic and treatment resistant, we can sometimes augment with anticonvulsants, and the augmentation, particularly with sodium valproate, has been shown to be effective. In some cases, there are case reports of augmentation with benzodiazepines, particularly the longer acting ones, but you need to remember to be quite cautious about the use of benzodiazepines in patients who are psychotic and who have had a traumatic brain injury because you might get a paradoxical effect of increased agitation and aggressiveness in the traumatically brain injured patient and find that they're more difficult to manage. Psychological interventions in psychotic states can have a role to play. I don't think they have a significant role to play in the acute phase apart from providing support and explanation to the patient. However, psychological management in the longer term is actually quite important in psychotic states. We know from our work with patients with schizophrenia that psychological intervention can be useful for the prevention of relapse and also for the management of treatment-resistant symptoms such as treatment-resistant hallucinations or delusional ideas. There have been a number of models of cognitive behaviour therapy designed for helping patients with psychosis deal with their treatment-resistant symptomatology. And while we don't have any studies of utilising these therapies in patients who have an organic psychosis or a schizophrenia following brain injury, it's likely that there will be some role for this type of management in these patients. It's probably important that we utilise such therapies for their individual symptoms rather than globally, and that the therapy needs to be modified according to the needs of the patient, bearing in mind their cognitive impairments that they have, and also taking into account the difficulties they may have with, say, attention or memory processes. If the appropriate modifications can be made, the cognitive behaviour therapies are going to have a role to play in managing individual symptoms. In people who have schizophrenia, we know that the concept of expressed emotion is important for relapse. That is, in families where there is high expressed emotion, there is an increased incidence of relapse in people with schizophrenia, even when they're compliant with medication. We also know that expressed emotion, or the tendency to have a high emotional state, can occur quite commonly following traumatic brain injury. So if you've got a person who's psychotic and traumatically brain injured, it's very likely that there will be a high degree of expressed emotion within that family. In this situation, utilising family therapy to reduce the amount of expressed emotion is important from the concept of relapse prevention and also to create an optimal environment as far as allowing the antipsychotics to do their job. The other area where family and family involvement is quite important is obviously in the area of compliance, not only compliance with the pharmacological therapy, but compliance with any cognitive or behaviour strategies that you may want to teach the person to help cope with their treatment-resistant psychotic symptoms, in particular, say, for example, their hallucinations or delusional ideas. The other area where I think it's important to look at family and family behaviour is, as I mentioned earlier, in the case of Miss G, you know, the family really often did things that exacerbated her paranoia. They would go through her room to find things because they were concerned about her confusion, but made it very obvious, which increased her degree of paranoia, and there was probably a better way of them dealing with this. And in the case of the young man I described who had the idea that he'd met me in the past many years ago and most of his other carers, working out very quickly that family members and carers who challenged his ideas tended to get hit meant that we could use an intervention with his environment to reduce them challenging his ideas and teaching people to move on. So therapy within the family to try and stop them, you know, challenging ideas and hallucinations to reduce the amount of aggressive behaviour is quite an important intervention. We know that carer burden is quite high in people who have who are caring for someone who has had a traumatic brain injury, and that carer burden is often higher, particularly when there are regressive behaviours. While there hasn't been a study looking at carer burden in patients who are psychotic, I know from my clinical experience that the partners of my psychotic patients often find it incredibly wearing and also quite frightening. They've found it hard enough to cope with the brain injury, but now they're coping with someone having hallucinations. And so we need to be aware of the fact that carer burden is higher when there's aggressiveness and that aggressiveness is higher in psychotic states. And we need to pay attention to this. We need to try and reduce the carer burden by providing appropriate respite services and providing them with education and understanding of how they can deal with the psychotic symptoms. As I mentioned earlier, we don't really have any case studies or, in fact, clinical trials of the effectiveness of these therapies in psychosis following brain injury, but we know that in non-traumatic brain injured populations, all these interventions are extremely useful and so should be applied to this patient population as well. What happens to people who develop a psychotic illness after a brain injury? Well, we don't actually have any studies to be able to tell us what will happen to such patients. And there are a lot of reasons for this. One of the most strong reasons for this is that, in fact, it is still actually quite a rare condition amongst head injured people. And often these patients are actually very difficult to follow up in treatment and in the longer term. They actually drop out of rehabilitation programs. They avoid being involved with medical services because of their belief system. And so it's been very hard to follow up such patients. In my clinical practice, where I've now managed a number of patients who've been psychotic over the years, often what you see is chronic symptomatology, so they'll have periods of exacerbation where they're less well, and then, you know, you change the medication or adjust the dose and they seem to settle down and become a lot better. One of the characteristic problems, though, that you can get, in fact, is that the delusional ideas of the person start to incorporate the treating team. And in the case of Miss G, after about 13 years of treatment, she started to incorporate myself within her delusional ideas. And she's incorporated her delusional ideas to her treating team in general, which means that she's really effectively avoiding having any involvement with any of her treating team. And her compliance and follow-up with therapy has, in fact, become very poor. Now, this is not an atypical situation that the delusional ideas might start to incorporate treating doctors, and this can have an effect as far as their outcome is concerned. What we can generally say about the outcome of people who become psychotic is that they do have a chronic course, but that the prognosis for each acute episode is fairly good. It's extremely rare in cases of psychosis after a brain injury that a person will have one episode and then not go on to have any further episodes. And often what you find is when they either stop their neuroleptics or discontinue in taking them at the prescribed dose, that their psychotic symptoms re-emerge. One of the things I might briefly mention in terms of outcome is that if a person has had a psychotic illness before their head injury, so they've had schizophrenia and then have a head injury, typically they seem to be more resistant to treatment and that their pattern of compliance and response to therapy deteriorates and they have a condition that's a lot harder to manage. What we know as far as our patients who have psychotic illness and are treated is that they have an increased risk of neurological side effects. With the typical neuroleptics, that tended to be tardive dyskinesia. With the atypical neuroleptics, what we're seeing is an emergence of problems with regards to weight gain, in particular obesity, hyperlipidemia and diabetes. Unfortunately, often in psychotic states, there's an association with smoking, so they can develop quite significant problems as far as health consequences are concerned. They also, over time, seem to become increasingly socially isolated, have increased social networks, which means that they become more and more isolated, and that often can feed into their paranoid delusional ideas and make it more difficult to manage them. If a person has had a traumatic brain injury and is being managed in the general psychiatric hospital, we know from a series of published studies that in fact they do less well in the general psychiatric hospital. They don't seem to respond as well to both medication and group therapy. Now, this data comes from one large study that was done looking at psychiatric hospital patients who'd had a traumatic brain injury, and the study did in fact make a retrospective assessment of brain injury, so how applicable that might be to those patients who are more severely injured is uncertain. But almost certainly clinically, I've often found the situation where mental health teams have not been able to capture the person in treatment or get a good relationship going, predominantly because they often forget that a lot of the cognitive effects of the head injury mean that the therapists have to actually work a lot harder to achieve that goal. One of the other problems that happens when a person has a psychotic illness after a brain injury is the effect that stress has on that psychotic illness. And a number of the patients that I've treated over the years who've become psychotic after their head injury, you know, we can treat their psychosis and they get well and they do very well on medication, but when they then return to rehabilitation and trying to go back into the workforce, they seem to relapse quite quickly. And what seems to happen is that the cognitive effects of the head injury, the stress of those cognitive effects in the real world, serve as a precipitant for the psychosis. So often when people become psychotic after a head injury, it's a poor prognostic sign as far as return to work is concerned, and they have a less than optimal outcome as far as rehabilitation. It's important also to note that often when people become psychotic after their brain injury, they're shifted from rehabilitation services to mental health services, and then they're actually lost to follow up from a rehabilitation perspective from their traumatic brain injury, and frequently you don't see that they're actually integrated back into a general rehabilitation program. That's going to be more common if their psychotic symptoms are more treatment resistant. Interestingly enough, there's no evidence to suggest clinically that they are in fact more treatment resistant. Often what's happened is that the dose of neuroleptics has been inadequate, or the agent chosen has been inadequate, or compliance has been poor, rather than the fact that the antipsychotics haven't worked. So in summary then, I've described to you that people following traumatic brain injury can have psychotic symptoms in the acute phase when they're in post-traumatic amnesia, and we know that that has no significance prognostically in the long term for the emergence of psychotic symptoms, and that they may develop psychotic symptoms following their emergence from post-traumatic amnesia. The psychotic symptoms they then develop have the characteristics of acute schizophrenia, in particular the positive symptoms of acute schizophrenia with hallucinations and delusions. And the nature of those hallucinations and delusions is just the same as that of a functional psychosis or the traditional schizophrenia not associated with an organic lesion. People who've had a head injury who seem to be more vulnerable to the emergence of psychotic symptoms are those people who've had lesions in the left temporal area, where there's an association often with epilepsy, and damage to the frontal regions, in particular the right frontal area and the right non-dominant parietal region. Australian studies have suggested that a positive family history of psychosis also increased the risks of the development of schizophrenia following traumatic brain injury, but these results have not been replicated anywhere else in the world. Finally, the patient with a psychosis following a traumatic brain injury will benefit from appropriate pharmacological therapy. One needs to have an increased awareness of their sensitivity to side effects, to the neuroleptics, and to use neuroleptics that will attempt to minimise these side effects in patients. If they receive appropriate therapy, they respond well to that therapy, but have often a chronic longitudinal course with ongoing symptoms throughout their adult life.